It sounds so, so correct that to be a Christian is to share a common, correct belief system with every other Christian who's ever lived, all the way back to the disciples. And that those who think correctly will somehow earn a reward, blessings, that they will be saved or honored at least in some way for having received and hung on to correct belief. And yet, the emphasis on correct thinking has brought devastation and destruction to the Christian church throughout its history. In the early days of the church, rather than coming to understand the teachings of Jesus more deeply, the church fought over whether or not it was okay to eat meat that had been first offered to an idol, or whether one could only be acceptable to God if one were circumcised or not at any age. The church debated violently in the first few hundred years about whether Jesus was God the Son or the Son of God or God in his chosen Son. And so when the dust settled and a correct answer to that was decided upon by a relatively few influential, powerful bishops, then every other point of view became labeled as heresy. In fact, the label of heresy, and heretic in particular, has always been the weapon of choice as those who had the greater power demonized and intimidated their opponents into submission. And of course, the centuries of religious wars and inquisitions, while mostly at their core are about a power struggle, but they're also a testament to the idea, the failed idea, that correct thinking is the mark of one who is a true, genuine Christian. Remember, the Inquisition's fundamental question and objective was to ascertain whether or not an individual had correct thinking. And where they did not appear to do so, they were punished, persecuted, or murdered by the correct thinking church. In the first century, in the earliest decades, there was no such thing immediately as heresy, because to have heresy, you must have orthodoxy, which is correct thinking. Small Christian communities believed what they wanted to and worshipped as they chose. And we can see from the book of Acts in particular and the New Testament that there was clearly a division of thinking of what was correct between the Gentile Christian communities and the Jewish Christian communities. There were no central authorities, no set rituals or liturgy, no agreed upon canon of scripture, no church hierarchy, and no established body of doctrine. So you have little to fight about other than these squabbles about how Jewish do you have to be and how Gentile can you be. In line with the toleration practiced throughout the Roman Empire, each group of Christians was free to believe whatever they wanted. They had many common beliefs, but they also had individual beliefs that developed along with that community's thinking. The natural consequence of this state of affairs was that ideas and practices in different communities diverged. It's simply not reasonable to think that a mostly black North African community would somehow develop exactly identical practices, liturgy, and even beliefs than a church in France, in Gaul, or a church in Macedonia, or a church in Germany, or what became Germany. Towards the end of the second century, Irenaeus, the Bishop of Lyon in France, believed that there was too much danger in the numerous opinions that were developing, and so he attempted to establish an Orthodox body of teaching near the end of the second century. And so he wrote a 5-volume work, and I've seen this, and I've seen how many chapters are in each book. His book was simply called Against Heresies. And Irenaeus listed every single known significant difference to what he believed in Christian theology and explained why they were all wrong. Every single one of them. It's a huge volume. And that book has become the basis for what and how the church decides what it will believe and what it won't. Not Jesus. Jesus didn't decide this. Irenaeus did. He also claimed that there was only one proper church, and that that one proper church had one proper belief. And anyone and everyone outside of that one proper church, remember, you have hundreds of communities with slight differences in their view. Irenaeus said one of those is correct. All others are wrong. And anyone outside of that now one church could not be saved. And other Christians were heretics and should be expelled, and in his words, if possible, destroyed. In the year 380, the Christian emperor Theodosius I stated, "We command that those persons who follow this rule shall embrace the name of Catholic Christian. The rest, however, whom we judge to be," that is, if you believe differently than the one Catholic in the sense of universal, "if you do not coincide your beliefs, align your beliefs with the one church that we have decided is the one church, we judge you to be demented and insane. And you shall sustain the infamy of heretical dogmas. Their meeting places, their churches, shall not receive the name of church, and they shall be smitten," which is another word for saying killed, "injured, wounded, punished, first by divine vengeance, and secondly, by the retribution of our own initiative." So God will bring vengeance upon you, firstly, and secondly, the church will bring vengeance upon you, "which we, the one church, shall assume in accordance with divine judgment. Whatever we do to you, if we consider you a heretic, if you are one of the other 999 points of view, if you are not the one view that we have selected, you will be punished by God first and then punished by us." St. Augustine taught that error has no rights. Thus, if you are in error, you have no rights. You have no right to live. He cited biblical texts to justify the use of compulsion to agree to the one view, notably Luke 14:16 to 23. Augustine said, "Had not Christ himself blinded Paul in order to bring him into the one light?" Thus, if Jesus would wound and injure one of his followers to cause him to see the light, then we must do whatever injury upon others to bring them into the light. According to Augustine, coercion using, in his words, "great violence" was justified. A war to preserve or restore the unity of the church to that one view was a just war. He called it bellum Deo auctore. That is a war waged by God himself. "We didn't even start this," he said. "We're simply servants of God. We're soldiers of God in his war against the other Christians." as in church history, so even today, a preoccupation with correct thinking isn't just a problem for one's own faith as times change, as information change, as your own points of view change, and now what was correct is no longer believed to be correct. As it is for your own faith, it can and does often have disastrous spiritual consequences for others around us. In surveys conducted by Peter Enns, the author of the book that I'm citing frequently here, The Sin of Certainty, in surveys conducted by Enns, he learned of many who were badgered, beaten down, berated, and bulldozed over the edge by fellow Christians and Christian leaders. And so they stopped going to church. They walked away from institutional Christianity in any form. They took a long break from God, or they simply walked away from the faith altogether. Enns writes, "You can only be misled, mistreated, emotionally abused, manipulated, looked down upon, or lied to by religious leaders and other brothers and sisters for so long before packing it in and joining the Rotary Club." Why did this happen? Why were these people abused and mistreated in his survey? Because they questioned what they were told to believe. Now remember, Peter Enns is a believer. He's a Christian pastor. He's gone to Christian seminary. He has his qualifications. He's not anti-Christian. He says, "When knowing what you believe is the non-negotiable," that is, no, we can't talk about this. No, we can't investigate and have a discussion and see if we're wrong. "When it is the non-negotiable center of true faith, then questions and critical self-examination pose a threat. And it's best for you just to keep quiet." To those who were abused, he said it didn't matter how gently or respectfully they started the conversation. They noted that all that seemed to matter to the church representatives was that the system was under attack from these other thoughts, and measures had to be taken to defend the faith. But a faith that eats its own not only drives people out, but also sends up a red flare to the rest of humanity that Christianity is just another exclusive members-only club, and that Jesus is a lingering relic of antiquity rather than a powerful, present-defining spiritual reality, a means by which a few gain power over others rather than, as Jesus demonstrated, an opportunity or even a movement which professed to relinquish power over others. And when the author of John 13:35 says that by this will all people know that you are my disciples, if we love one another. But what non-Christians see is animosity, division, exclusion, and rejection. How are they supposed to see Jesus in the church? I like how Enns puts it, and I'm sure that we can relate this to our own experience. He says, "Under the high, lofted banner of defending the gospel, backroom politicking, gossip, maligning the character of their enemies, lying, vengeance, and even destroying people's livelihoods are excused as regrettable but necessary. Necessary tactics in their holy war to root out traitors harboring unbelief. And as such, casualties, unfortunate as they are nevertheless deemed necessary when truth is compromised, when correct thinking is compromised, and the gospel seems to be at stake. There's nothing like being subject to Christians of ill will to expose the dark underbelly of where this preoccupation with correct thinking can get you, and to begin seeing, as I hope we all can, a need for a different kind of faith. So what's the solution to these dilemmas posed by the certainty and the error of correct thinking? Well, the answer certainly cannot be a new correct thinking that replaces the old correct thinking. It can't be, well, this is what you used to believe, this is what you were previously taught to believe, this is what you used to think was the only right way, now here is the right way, the new right way, the new correct thinking. Because we're no further ahead, and that's hypocritical. Instead, I'd like to present some points to ponder as you come to grips with faith as it might be better understood, a faith that can stand up to the realities of life today that don't make us deny what science, what modern scholarship, what archaeology can inform us about the Word of God and the Bible and biblical history and all those things that affect the doctrines that we teach. The first point is simply, thank you, modernity. Modernity and everything that is available to us to learn, to know, is not a threat to the church. Well, it is a threat to the institutional church, but it's not a threat to the church as the body of Christ. The last few hundred years have exposed not a problem with faith, but a problem with faith that is grounded in the need to have certainty and a correct thinking that is fixed and immovable, with answers for everything, and a faith that treats the Bible as if God personally wrote it like his journal. That sort of faith is on very shaky ground. When reading the Bible, honestly, when you read it, you see that God is sometimes presented as a callous monster. Or we recognize, on the other hand, the very human within the scriptures, the very human search and the sometimes finding God, while at other times in those same scriptures imposing human traits and characteristics onto that God that are more about us than a real God. It is simply not a good enough excuse for the litany of Old Testament death and destruction to say, but those were different times. It's different today. That's Old Testament. New Testament is different. In other words, it's like saying, well, it used to be okay for God to love only Israel and to destroy all other nations and peoples because they had the wrong God. But now, today, in the New Testament, under grace, God loves everybody. Or, as some people have told me, humans are basically worms. Filth, useless hunks of meat, born, deprived, depraved, condemned for the curiosity and the disobedience of a man who supposedly lived 6,000 years ago. Is that the answer? Is that real? Is that what the scriptures tell us? That we're condemned from birth, before we've ever sinned, for the curiosity and disobedience of a man and a woman 6,000 years ago? Is it really true that we deserve nothing but death before we've committed our first sin? And that it's only by the grace of God that we're even breathing in the first place? Is that what you think God thinks about you and your daughter when she was born and your grandson when he was born? Useless worm, filthy, sinful hunk of meat that really, if it were not for the grace of God, should just disappear, should die. Those who believe this, and again, I've been told this by Christians. And so any under that circumstance, and all murders that we would call murders are not murders, they're just killings. As if there was a difference. But all murders ordered by God in the Old Testament are completely justified. Even the case in, I think it's Kings, I forget if it's 1st or 2nd Kings, where some kids laugh at Elisha because he's bald. or going bald. And so, it's, according to the scriptures, God sends two female bears to rip these 42 children into shreds, killing them all, because they were disrespectful to one of God's prophets. Or does that sound more like that's a warning to people, don't disrespect God's prophets, because God's prophets don't like to be disrespected? Surely we must read the Bible differently than fundamentalists. Accepting the scientific method of understanding reality, accepting modern biblical scholarship, imperfect and incomplete as it is, accepting new ways of recognizing what is good and what is evil, surely all of that builds our faith, builds our confidence, develops and matures our trust. Making it so that it will stand strong as future changes continue to affect our belief system. For example, surely owning other human beings for any reason, but especially owning them in order to make them work for you as a slave, is and was always wrong, right? Owning as a piece of property, you owning as if you owned an armchair or a car or a house, owning a human being is wrong. Always was wrong. But owning them to make them work for you, because you probably bought them as an item of property, surely that is wrong. The Bible doesn't present that point of view. It presents it as acceptable, Old and New Testament. Just be kind to your slaves, it says in the New. Be a little nicer than you were to them in the Old Testament. Surely treating wives as property, as something to, and daughters as something to trade, surely that is wrong. Surely a husband does not own his wife, and a father does not own his daughter. Right? We know that to be wrong, immoral, unethical, unloving. Surely accepting all people who wish to fellowship with you in peace, regardless of their sexual orientation, is right, isn't it? Just having people in your home, having people in your church congregation, having people in your community, even if you disagree with how they live their life, but accepting all people, not judging anybody, is always right, isn't it? As Peter Enns put it, the challenges of modernity, and it's modernity that has taught us that these things are wrong, because slavery is still going on in parts of the world, because modernity hasn't reached there yet. But the challenges of modernity have shaken our sense of certainty. And to that I say, good. Thank you. And in doing so, it has moved us away from dogma and certainty and moved us towards trust. Secondly, we cannot get our minds around God, even though many people claim they can. We simply can't. So be okay with that. I don't think that the Christian faith is fundamentally rational. By that I mean, it cannot be fully captured by our rational faculties. And in fact, more often than not, our rational faculties confound our ideas of God. If that is true, then why are some of us trying to be certain about God with dogmatic theology, whereby we attempt to explain exactly who and what God is? Now, if someone wants to do that, and they hold those beliefs, and they're certain about those beliefs, that's fine. But the insistence that there's one way to think about these things, that anything outside of that one way is heresy, is absolutely pathetic. As pathetic as it was in the first century, or the second century, or the third century, when any other points of view were automatically assumed to be wrong. this recent fixation by some evangelicals on Trinitarian theology is smoke and mirrors. It is, as I like to call it, fiction created by fixation. Fiction created by fixation. Let me repeat. The modern obsession with Trinitarian theology is fiction. It's made up. It's not in the Bible. By that I mean that if you stare at the clouds long enough, you will see faces. You will see animals. You will see monsters. If you fixate on it, if you look at it, if you stare into it long enough, focus your entire attention on something like that, you will see things that are not there, and you will be convinced that that is just like a face. In fact, some people have believed that angels were in there looking back at them, or that it was God looking at them. We see what we want to see. That is true in all of life. So if we decide that a not-in-the-Bible doctrine such as the Trinity is true, and we want to be at the leading edge of this theology, and so we focus all of our energy and resources on it in order to appear progressive and perhaps to distance ourselves from some embarrassing past doctrinal errors, then we need to hire a well-respected Trinitarian theologian. No Trinitarian theologian is ever going to tell you anything other than the Trinity is true. Because that's what he does, or she does. That's their belief system. And if you pay them very, very well to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, to stare into those Trinitarian clouds, what are they going to see? They're going to see that what they already decided was true is true. Amazing. You see what you want to see. Now, this doesn't prove that the Trinity isn't true. I'm saying that when you start out with the dogma that it must be true, you will find what you're looking for, and you will find ways to mold those scriptures to make it say absolutely anything you want. So my question is, why does the church need to be certain about God? Why does the church need this? Why do we have to have one single answer to everything? The answer is rather unfortunate. The answer, as I see it, is because church members expect the church to be certain about God. The church itself, the people in the pews, need the church to have dogmatic answers, even if they aren't complete or accurate. We're not okay with the answer, we don't really know, or I'm not sure. We have thousands of different ways of answering that question. You, the church member, and I'm speaking to all millions of Christians, we all sadly expect that from the church, and the church is happy to provide the answer. If it's not true that God is beyond our rational faculties, that is, if God is entirely knowable, or almost all, then I would ask next, which description of God is accurate? And good luck feeling confident that someone else's description or their package of ideas about God is maybe not a little better than yours, unless you're narcissistic enough to believe that your God has granted you special insight just for you and no one else. Because if yours is different and yours is right, everyone else is wrong. And luckily for you, yours is right. Each scholar, each denomination may say, yes, it's us. And every scholar and every denomination does say, yes, it is us, it is me. We are the ones who know precisely or the most about who and what God is. Come follow us. But again, the burning question is, why would God reveal special insight only to you and not the exact same insight to every Christian everywhere for the last 2,000 years, and also to the Jews? Why would he hide it from them in the wilderness in Israel? Why would he not want people to know who he is, if God is knowable in that sense? A God who can be comfortably captured in our mind, with little else for us to find out, apart from an occasional adjustment, is no God at all. It's a figment of our imagination. Third, Christianity, by its very nature, is a setup for letting go of certainty. What are the two fundamental doctrines of Christianity? Incarnation and resurrection. There's more to the Christian faith than that, but how interesting that the two elements that make Christianity what it is both completely dodge our powers of thought and speech. Incarnation is that God in some way became one of us, or came into one of us in some special and unique way. What does that mean? The Gospels don't tell us what that means or how that happened. What words do you use to express it, let alone comprehend it? And resurrection? Surely that is the ultimate reversal of the one certainty in life for all of us, death. You die and then you come back to life again? That doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. Both of these are utterly beyond what is knowable by any means by which we determine things: observation, experience, and testing. You can't observe resurrection. You can't experience incarnation, and you can't test any of it. These mysteries are known only by trust. So Christianity is about letting go of certainty. Fourth, we need to adjust our expectations about what the Bible can deliver. The Bible is referred to as a holy book that more often than not doesn't act very much like it's holy. It looks more like a book written 2,000 to 3,000 years ago by people who acted that way at that time. The Bible reflects fully the ancient setting in which it is written, just as the songs we sing today reflect the age and the time and the community that wrote those songs. And therefore, it's not a script that can simply be dropped down into our lives today without a lot of thought and wisdom. The Bible must be thought through. It must be pondered. It must be tried out. It must be assessed and challenged, and if necessary, argued with, all of which are expressions of faith, not evidence to the contrary. It's because we have faith. It's because we trust. Not trust the word, we trust the God behind the word. Fifth, God is not a crutch. If Christianity is true, then it has to be for some other reason than I need it to be true. When people say things like, if I didn't have my faith, I wouldn't be able to have made it through this. It was only my faith that kept me going. When people say things like that, they're expressing their need for the God that they have imagined, or the God they have accepted because he appears to promise the things that we want. In other words, for many people, as much as they believe in the God that they conceive of as the God presented in the Bible, it's not technically the same thing, but a construction of our own minds and creativity and imagination. Sixth and finally, struggling with faith is normal. Faith is not the same thing as fact. Faith is not science. Science and fact are there or they're not. It's true or it's not. It's obvious, it's testable, it's knowable or it's not. Faith is different. And so, of course, struggling is normal. Struggling is part of the mystery of faith, and it's okay when things don't line up perfectly. I want to conclude by saying we spent a lot of time in the previous two and today in the series on the sin of certainty. We spent a lot of time talking about what faith is not and why certainty is not actually faith. That can be discouraging and leave one with a sense of hopelessness. And some of you may have been experiencing some of that hopelessness or helplessness or lostness. Well, what now? And so next time we'll conclude this series by looking at what a real faith looks like and how the struggles with faith make us more Christ-like, not less.